Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Sarah Kessler. Sarah is a reporter at Quartz, where she writes about the future of work. Before joining Quartz in 2016, she covered the gig economy as a senior writer at Fast Company and managed startup coverage at Mashable. Her reporting has been cited in the Washington Post, New York Magazine, and NPR. Her new book is called Gigged: The End of the Job and the Future of Work. Sarah Kessler, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I was both a bit surprised and ashamed by the time I finished reading Gigged. Surprised because I knew that there were inherent challenges with regard to the gig economy, but I still was operating with this like reflexive positivity about what it could represent for the future of work. And the shame came from recognizing that in many ways, the gig economy is just a contemporary version of the same underlying inequities that hurt people who don't have privilege. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm so glad that you read the book.
Well, I've got to talk to you, don't I?
Yeah.
I know that not everyone does, but you say, you know, that of the tech industry, of course, they tend to frame everything in terms of the world-changing positive social impact, but this is really dark side of the gig economy.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think kind of when a lot of these apps were getting started, it was easy for them to make the pitch that they were going to save the world through these things. At the time, I was working as a startup reporter at Mashable, and I was interviewing two or three of them every single day. And that was really the trend, is this is going to save the world. And not only that, but really kind of fundamentally change how we work. And so the more that I looked at it and the more I talked to people working this way, I found that that's really maybe the way that it would work for them, and the way that it works for a lot of freelancers is that they have this flexibility and this freedom to work whenever they want, to press a button and get to work, but that it looks a lot different if you don't have those advantages.
Right. And you, one of the things I do want to get to is the various people that you focus on in the book. And it's nice to have these faces that go along with things like Uber or Mechanical Turk, the other stuff you talk about. But first, I want to jump into Uber because that's sort of the – I mean, you end your book taking an Uber ride. I was in it yesterday, but it's so problematic. And you write, quote, Uber avoided medallions, special license plates, and other government-created systems aimed at regulating taxi and limousine companies by claiming that it was a technology company rather than a transportation company. And that's egregious, I think.
Yeah, really, if you look at kind of the innovation of Uber and why it works so well, you can't deny that the experience is better than hailing a cab.
Right.
But a lot of the advantages that they have is avoiding these regulations. And, you know, that's a big part about what makes them successful.
And what you referred to before, that it may sound really promising, but you're not taking into effect perhaps that they got to buy gas, insurance, they've got car payments, oil changes, car washes. And they're not even making minimum wage potentially, right?
Yeah, some people say that they don't. And if you look at analysis of Uber wages, a lot of times they're above minimum wage, but not so much, you know, comparable with like a job at a fast food restaurant or a retail store clerk. And what is, I think, especially egregious about that, there's, you know, that's above the minimum wage. But the way that Uber advertised this was not as that job. They really kind of made this pitch that by joining Uber, you would be your own boss and the proprietor of your own business. And this was kind of a step up in your path on the American dream. They early on released a press release that said drivers made $90,000 a year on average without ever, you know, mentioning kind of all those costs that you did or that they pay double taxes. And were actually sued for misrepresenting the job. Internally, in presentations, they were talking about how the competition for kind of getting people to work for Uber were jobs at McDonald's while they were making this pitch that it was about freedom and flexibility and entrepreneurship.
You bring up the fact that in a system like Uber, co-workers, you know, which are the other people driving, they have no way to talk to each other. And this is an overall problem in the gig economy, which is what you lose by not being part of a connected workforce is any, I mean, first of all, you can't collectively bargain. It makes it hard to strike. But then you have no sort of you're not building relationships with other people who are in the same business.
Yeah, exactly. And some of them do go online and look for that. And it's both things like trying to organize collectively, which for a lot of reasons, including that you have no federally protected right to unionize, is very difficult. So that's one aspect of it. But also you see people who work on these systems kind of trading information because they have no other way to do it online about, you know, where can you find the best jobs? What's the best time to work? How do you get paid much? How do you, you know, game the system? There's a lot of kind of framing of this kind of work is a system that both sides are trying to game, you know, because Uber doesn't directly manage you, but they set up incentives or penalties that are intended to make you do certain things. And so you have people trying to figure out how to best manipulate that system in order to make the most money.
And I thought this was an incredible quote that you cite John Koopman, who is interviewing an Uber driver in San Francisco, who said, quote, "I think of Uber as a modern day version of the Works Progress Administration during the Depression. Thanks to Uber, I am not poor. I am just nobody." Wow. That's such a sad statement, really, at the end.
Yeah. And I think he had been laid off from a newspaper and wrote about how he does like driving for Uber and how it did save him, which early on, Travis Kalanick did position it as a safety net for the city because you can just press a button and get to work. I think that it probably does work that way for somebody, but you need to ask what happens to the, you know, real social safety net when this is your alternative, in which it doesn't apply. You know, things like unemployment insurance, disability, the option to have employer-provided health insurance, kind of all these things are attached to direct employment.
Right. Okay, I want to talk about some of the people that you met along the way. And you talk about two gentlemen who started a company called Managed by Q, which basically was sort of like Uber for cleaning, I think. And can you tell us a little bit about those two and the arc of their story in the book?
Sure. So, yeah, it was really interesting to follow them and particularly to follow them for the full, you know, 3 years that I was talking to them because they had such a journey. And out of the gate, they were starting around the same time that a lot of these companies, you know, Uber for cleaning, Uber for dog walking, Uber for everything. And kind of getting pressure to use a similar model for their business, which was office cleaning and office, you know, anything that you would need in an office, whether it be catering or, you know, whatever. But they started out with cleaning. And so at first they thought, okay, we're just tech guys. We're going to build this tech product. And kind of as an afterthought, oh, we need cleaners. We'll just hire kind of these other companies to do it. After a while, they realized that in order to really provide good service, they need to have a relationship with the people who are actually doing the work, and that, like, unlike maybe driving from point A to point B, people really care about how you clean their office or, you know, actually show up. And so they they decided to kind of make this huge change and create a good job for service workers, which is kind of, you know, they paid a living wage, they provided a career path, they paid full health insurance and set up 401ks with matching, and their cleaners have much better benefits than I do, which is almost unheard of in that industry and very unheard of in tech, which has, you know, maybe large service workforces, but they're never given the same benefits as engineers. And so they were able to build a business and hire, you know, thousands of people doing that. And so that was really great. And it showed that you could make a sustainable business by empowering people and employing them directly. On the other hand, you know, a big part of their business today as they expand is a platform that allows you to hire other people's businesses to do things like clean or provide catering. They install kind of dashboards and offices where office managers can order any sort of services that they need. And so that was very much the part that made them a scalable tech startup. And so if you think about kind of the needs of like the way that capital works and the way that what investors are interested in are not those like slowly scaling sustainable businesses that treat employees well. So there's a mixed story there.
Yeah. And what I was surprised to learn too is that you talk about many of these companies that started out as part of the gig economy. A lot of them had to change their business models, or they just failed. So, like this sort of rush to that world didn't work out so well for, I would guess, the most of them.
Yeah, it's hard to find. You know, there were not so many of the Uber for X companies that ended up, you know, working out. What I think that they did do is demonstrate that technology can allow you to hire people to work in different ways. Like, they can figure out how to incentivize you to be in a certain place at a certain time, make it easier to find a freelancer. Mm-hmm. And that's the part when I think people are saying, like, what does this mean? You know, it's not a huge percentage of the workforce today, but the worry is that, you know, we'll get better and better at this, and soon nobody will be an employee, which... you know, depending on whose story you're looking at, you might think is a great thing or not a great thing.
Yeah, as I'm reading your book, I'm talking to people here at Second City, and you know, there's a lot of actors here, and they're like, "Well, like, we're in the gig economy. We've always been in the gig economy." And I'm like, "I guess that's true for our field." You actually kind of went undercover, right? You applied for a cleaning gig from one of these other companies.
I wouldn't call it undercover, but I attended an information session that was open to the public or open to anyone who applied. Mm-hmm. Which I did using my real name and my real information. And what was interesting about it is when you call your workers independent contractors, you're supposed to not have control over them. Otherwise, you make yourself vulnerable to all sorts of lawsuits that say, hey, you actually have employees, but you're just calling independent contractors to get out of paying, you know, into Social Security for them. So what was interesting about the information session is that they kind of really toe the line on not telling you to do things. So instead of saying, like, okay, make sure you take your shoes off when you get to the when you get to your house, mm-hmm. you know, it might be, well, our 5-star cleaners who get 5 stars from customers tend to take their shoes off right when they get to the house. Mm. You know, instead of you must show up, you know, we're going to schedule you and you have to be there. It's, we're going to schedule you. And if you don't show up, we're going to charge you $50 and we'll just take that out of your pay. Mm. And it was interesting because it was very much, you know, presented to the people who showed up to the orientation as a job. You know, I found the listing on Craigslist. It said you could make so much an hour. And, you know, then they kind of are realizing, like, wait a minute, we have to buy our own supplies? And the moderator's like, well, yeah, of course you are, because you're your own business, remember? And it was clearly, you know, that aspect was a little bit of a surprise.
I also enjoyed. I enjoyed that at the end of the meeting, someone said, "Well, if we have a serious problem, we should call you, right?" And their response was, "Don't call us."
Yeah, exactly. They're trying to teach you, no, go look at the app. Go look at the Q&A section at the app.
Wow.
And some of, yeah.
That's crazy. All right, there's some other stuff in here that also really surprised me. One of the things that you note is that temporary workers have a higher rate of injury than traditional employees. Why? How does that happen?
That is a good question. I think if you asked some people, they might think that it's because they're treated as disposable workers or they're, you know, they do the more dangerous work. I think that there's a lot of benefit to having a direct employment relationship with the place where you do the work.
Right.
Part of it is just the humanness of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that there's data that explains that.
Right, right.
Well, more, in a satisfying way.
Yeah, more generally, the line you had that really stuck to me was that, quote, risk had migrated from companies to workers. And you can see that across the board, right? If, you know, a company does so much in terms of protecting its people from all kinds of stuff. And if you just don't have that, you are opening yourself up to lots of potential problems.
Yeah. And part of the point I was trying to make in the book is that, kind of the Silicon Valley version of this trend was one thing, but that this is part of a bigger thing. And even direct employees, you know, used to have their companies take the risk of promising that they would have a certain pension when they retired, and maybe like the investment didn't work out. Like now, instead, people have 401ks where they take the risk where maybe they put in money to their retirement and they don't get out what they expected. You know, health and insurance premiums are changing in a way that put more on the employees. There's less unemployment insurance than there used to be, you know, federal unemployment insurance ended years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's only state. So there's all these examples of, even if you're in a full-time job, there's been well documented this risk transfer from companies to employees.
Yeah. And you bring up Silicon Valley. So I was just there. I was at the Code conference, and Senator Mark Warner was there, and he comes up in your book because he actually, at a certain point, has tried to do something here. Can you talk to us about what Senator Warner has done or tried to do?
Sure. So he has tried to, one, encourage kind of the government to collect better data on workers, which on contingent workers, on workers who aren't working in traditional jobs, which was successful. And they did do a survey that was released today, actually.
Hmm.
And then the second part of what he did, it was push for benefits that work better for people in these alternate work arrangements or are untied from your job. So right now, a lot of people feel, you know, their health insurance keeps them in a job,
right?
Because it's attached to their job, but it doesn't have to be that way. And in most countries, it's not that way. The reason that that's this way in the United States is kind of an accident of history. So, you know, what are ways that we could instead have companies pay into a fund that travels with a worker no matter where they're working? Or, you know, you could do the same for retirement savings. So he's been pushing for that. He proposed creating a fund that would create experiments in these types of benefits. Unfortunately, in today's U.S. Congress, there's not, you know, a ton of things getting done, and that proposal has gone nowhere.
Ugh.
But, you know, he tried.
Yeah, yeah. He and the interesting thing, you know, when he was interviewed on stage, and this was before Sheryl Sandberg was going to come out and talk about Facebook in their grilling of Mark Zuckerberg, and he's like, "Yeah," he goes,
mm-hmm.
"He goes, I thank God I wasn't on that committee." In part because he's like, you know, he grew up. I mean, he was an entrepreneur and a tech entrepreneur, so he knows a little bit of something about that before he went into the into government. Fairly painful to watch that experience, just bad. It's interesting. I was looking at the World Economic Forum's future of work skills for the future, and they include things like, you know, storytelling, divergent thinking, problem solving, and it doesn't feel like any of, like, most of this gig economy stuff doesn't really, you know, tap into those really important skills.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you're a freelance advertising creative, maybe you use a storytelling skill. And whenever I see one of those reports, I am very skeptical, because who knows what the future of work looks like.
Yeah.
I don't know that the, like, if you are working in the gig economy, certainly things like having an entrepreneurial mindset, depending on if you're truly a small business or if you're working on an app that tells you exactly where to be at exactly which time, you know, might be important.
Mm-hmm.
This might be one of the things that you cut out of the interview, because basically I don't know what skills you'll need for the future.
I don't think we need to cut it out. I mean, it's very true, right? So everyone's making guesses, you know, as to this stuff. But I think that the sort of salient point here in the book is we kind of got sold this bill of goods with regard to how great the gig economy could be, how you're it's autonomy and you know, you don't have to worry about bosses, you are all the stuff you talked about. But it's really fraught with problems, and it's not working out great for a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. I think that it could work out better for more people. And there are a lot of people who do have this happy story of how it fixes some problems with a 9-to-5 job, which, if you look at it, does have problems. You know, for instance, it's created at a time when we thought an ideal family would have, you know, a woman who stayed home all day long taking care of kids and housework and family, which, you know, obviously increasingly, to the extent that that was ever the case of a typical family, it's no longer the case. And so you have these people trying to juggle careers and a full-time job at home and, you know, all at once.
Right.
So, like, that's broken. I think the idea that as people live longer, which kind of all the data suggests that lifespans are increasing a lot, and not only that, but kind of time in which you have, like, before you're disabled is increasing. So you might have a 60-year career. I think the idea that you're going to work 9-to-5 that entire time is also, like, a way in which it doesn't work with our current state. So there is right. there are these things that are broken. The gig economy could help. The way that we're currently structured isn't one in which supports that well for people who don't start with a ton of advantages.
Yeah. I'm curious too, with you in the process of writing the book, did you write the book you thought you were going to write? Did you make discoveries in the process that were unique and surprising to you?
I guess when I started out, I knew that I wanted to tell a story from the perspective of people who were actually doing the work, because I felt I was hearing a lot from entrepreneurs and politicians and union leaders, and that perspective was underrepresented. And I also thought that I wanted it to make it a story that would be pleasant to read and not kind of a business book full of bullet points. But I didn't really know what to expect when I started following people.
Mm-hmm.
And I followed a lot more than that are in the book. And some of them I, you know, maybe picked up halfway through, so I had a little bit of a better idea. And by the time I started writing the book, I had already kind of gone through a little bit of the a change in how I saw the gig economy when I first heard about it when I was 22 and a startup reporter. You know, I thought, like, yes, this is the future, and this is so great, and I'm going to leave my job now because that sounds awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then
not so much.
As I looked into it further, you know, that had already kind of been dispelled.
Yeah, one of the stories I want to ask you about too, but, and this is before I'm going to ask you for a yes and story at the end, which is what we always ask our guests. But one of the stories that really connected with me and I thought was really interesting was the mom from Toronto, Christy Milland, I think is her name.
Mm-hmm.
So tell a little bit about her, because I thought her arc and her journey and where she ended up was fascinating, given where she started.
Okay, so Christy is awesome. She's super driven, super, like, knows what she wants and entrepreneurial and very cool woman. She had been, like, working on this platform called Amazon Mechanical Turk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this platform that Amazon runs where there's all these sorts of small jobs. And so, for instance, when you're training artificial intelligence, how to recognize a picture, you need, you know, it doesn't learn by saying, like, okay, a cat has a tail, it has two ears. Instead, it learns more like a kid, which is you show it like 10,000 pictures of a cat, and then eventually it can recognize one.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs somebody to go and label 10,000 pictures of cats. And that's an example of a task that might end up on Mechanical Turk, like label this slideshow of animals for, you know, 30 cents. Or write these descriptions for a website, every product, you can have 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So, she was doing that for kind of extra money. And then her husband lost his job. He had been working in a factory and she knew she had to make money right away. And the first thing that came to mind was, oh, I'll work on Amazon Mechanical Turk. So this became her full-time job for a while. And believe it or not, because, she did a bunch of smart things, like figure out how to find the best tasks and figure out how to do them way more quickly than I could.
Mm-hmm.
She was able to make $40,000 a year. But in the process, she recognized that there were things that weren't so great about it. You know, like she didn't feel like the people who was she working with, they treated her like she was code, not like she was a human.
Right.
You know, for instance, there's this academic researcher who said, like, okay, I'm going to do a study where I test how long people will stick with a task as I show that as it becomes increasingly unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
So he put a bunch of slideshows up on Amazon Turk, Amazon Mechanical Turk, that, like, started with kitties and rainbows and then finished with, you know, like, beheadings and, you know, gross medical conditions. And his, like, objective was to see when people would quit. So, she connected with these academic researchers who were trying to figure out, like, what would it look like if people who are working this way organized collective action. And they together built this platform that was intended to do that. And so kind of in the book, you learn, like, all the reasons why, though this idea was promising, it didn't work out. But then Christy herself, she first got a master's in labor studies, and then now is in law school. Like, this experience kind of becoming an activist really inspired her, and she is continuing her education.
Yeah, it's a really cool story. Okay, the way we end every one of these podcasts is we ask our guest for a yes and story. So the idea in improvisation is that when you want to make something out of nothing, which is what we do, you can't start by saying no, and you can't just say yes. You have to say yes, and you have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I wonder if you have a story for us from your life or your work where you would normally have said no, but instead said yes, and.
Yes, I do. The story I'm going to tell you is about my first journalism job. So I was in high school. My school had no high school paper, so that wasn't an option. I knew I wanted to be a journalist. So I basically begged the editor of the local paper. This was in small town Wisconsin. Paper was very small. You know, hire me. I'm 16, but I can do this. And he did.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the only writer at the paper. I was writing stories about, like, quilting circles and swimming lessons and other hard-hitting topics for $50 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went on vacation, and the county council, like the council of government for the county, had this huge scandal, and he was like, I'm leaving for where was he going? Cancun. But you should cover this. So I have no experience whatsoever, go to this meeting of where this huge thing is going on. There's like there's reporters from, you know, neighboring counties, and this feels like a big deal. I have never, like, I don't know how this government works. I'm 16. I cannot tell you enough how little I knew what I was doing. I sat next to the reporter from the Janesville Gazette and tried to look at what he was writing down.
Perfect.
So that I could write it down. they had a closed door meeting, and afterwards I was like, oh, okay. You know, as they were coming out, I was like, hey, what happened? And everyone was like, it was a closed door meeting. We're not going to tell you. So basically, just no idea, but wrote a story. It published in the paper. I don't know if it was good or not. I'm not going to go read it because I don't really want to know. And I loved it, and it kind of got me started. So
I love
that
it.
That is my yes and.
You yes-anded your way into your career.
Yes.
The book is called Gigged, The End of the Job and the Future of Work. Sarah Kessler, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm up before the sun. When my work day is over, too tired for having fun. I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
Lord, I am so tired. How long can this go on?
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine.
Working.